Oh. Video come to order.
I don't even know who got it, to be honest. So, no, I'm sorry. Not,
okay.
Yeah,
all right. So we have a motion to approve the minutes.
I'd like to move it on.
Representative Powell moves to approve the minutes of Thursday, March 4th. All in favor, please say aye.
Yes.
Aye. All opposed, no. Minutes are approved.
One down.
Okay. The first bill we have up is House File 42. Representative Thiessen, would you like to move your bill?
I'll move the bill, Madam Chair, and refer it to the committee on Mahoney's committee.
Okay. Representative Thiessen moves to take House File 42 off the table.
Yes.
And we have to vote on that motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails, and House File 42 is taken off the table. Okay. So, Representative Thiessen, you have an amendment to your bill. Would you like to move your amendment?
DE4-1 amendment.
Okay. Representative Thiessen moves the DE4-1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which he would like to discuss it.
And, Madam Chair, I think I also then want to move the A3 amendment to the DE1 amendment.
Okay.
So it's an amendment to the amendment.
Okay. So, okay. All right. My expert here tells me that we vote first on the A3 amendment. No, I don't think we can do that. The amendment is not
the amendment. The amendment.
Okay. So we're going to vote on the amendment to the amendment first. So Representative Thiessen moves the A3 amendment to the DE4-1 amendment. And Representative Thiessen, would you like to just very briefly explain what you're doing here before we vote?
I think it'll be easier if we could put the amendment to the amendment on, and then I'll just explain the amendment.
Okay.
These are technical changes.
All right. Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Okay. So all those in favor of the A3 amendment to the DE4-1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. And that amendment to the amendment is adopted. And then, Representative Thiessen, do you want to then explain your amendment as amended, or do you just want to adopt it and then explain what you're doing?
Maybe why don't we just put the amendment on, and then, because it's a delete all, that's the bill then.
Okay, very good. So, all right, so all in favor of the DE4-1 amendment as amended, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. All right, the DE4-1 amendment is adopted. All right, to your bill as amended, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, we saw this bill early in the session, and we've been working on it quite a bit since. And as you know, there's also been some federal stimulus law that has addressed this issue of health care for people that are unemployed or lose their jobs. And we're all aware right now that the unemployment rate continues to climb. I think the last number was 7.6% in Minnesota. And parts of the state in greater Minnesota are reaching 10 and 11% unemployment. And, you know, we all know, and I think hear from our constituents, that Minnesotans are hurting, and there's likely there's not really a bottom in sight at this point, at least. Unfortunately, and what this bill will do is basically, you know, the federal stimulus bill provided a 65% match for COBRA payments. And what this bill will do is try to fill in some of the gaps that are left. So the people that it will help are people that had jobs and lost their employment, and you have to work for 18 months prior to losing your job to qualify under this legislation. So if you worked 18 months after and then are unemployed, likely it's going to be people that didn't have insurance through their employer, so we're having buying an individual policy, kind of paying for that out of their own pocket, which, as you know, we all know, can be a fairly expensive proposition. And we also will be focusing in on those folks who, even with the 65% COBRA subsidy, and we talked about this in the last hearing we had on it, these COBRA plans are often quite expensive. And even the 35% left over can run into the hundreds of dollars a month, and these are folks where the average, you know, they're averaging maybe $1,100 a month in their unemployment benefits. And so to the extent that they're paying more than 8% to cover the 35%, we'll help them make up the debt, or they can qualify for this program as an alternative. So at the bottom line, what this is doing at this point is waiving the four-month rule. So people that lose their jobs can get into Minnesota Care without waiting the 4 months that you typically do. And a couple of questions that I just... Oh, and the other thing that it does is it does allow people who take this 145 days, and this is a temporary Minnesota Care fee, but only lasts 145 days, then you'd have to either reapply for Minnesota Care or find another insurance product to help you out. And I guess the last thing that I would point out is if you qualify for group coverage through your spouse or through Medicare, you would not qualify for this as well. And it only applies to people up to 275% of poverty. So we're actually talking about a fairly narrow group of people at this point who we're trying to help out. But nonetheless, these are people that I think really need the help. Two things. The last thing that it does is it does say that if you have, if you take this temporary Minnesota Care and then don't qualify for Minnesota Care subsequently, that you would have 63 days to find insurance in the private market, and it would be guarantee issue at that point. So they couldn't deny you coverage at that point for pre-existing conditions. And my sense on that, and I think we'll have testimony about that, I don't think that there's a concern about adverse selection with that guarantee issue because this is such a narrow and in some sense randomly chosen group of people. I think there will be a concern expressed that we're setting a precedent that we don't want to set. And you know, that I think is something that, you know, I think there's arguments on both sides of that issue. The other thing that I, the other issue that I'd just like to address is that there is concern, I think, about inequities related to this legislation. You know, why this group of people as opposed to other groups of people. And I think my sense on that, and I thought a lot about that, and I think that the, you know, there are people that are qualified for Minnesota Care today because of they're eligible under their income and haven't applied. And it strikes me that if you haven't taken advantage, you know, if the four-month rule is passed and you haven't taken advantage, in some sense I have less sympathy in that world. The one group I think that there is a real equity argument to be made are people whose employers drop coverage but keep them employed. You know, so in this time, as people, you know, as employers are facing rising healthcare costs and a tough economy, they may choose to drop their employment. In those circumstances, people would still have to wait 4 months to qualify for Minnesota Care. So that seems to me to the one group where the equities actually line up, and we're advantaging one group over another group. I guess that would be the last piece. Finally, well, not really last piece, one more piece, I guess. I'm kind of going off the top of my head here. The last piece, I guess, I would say is that there is concern about where we are going to be allocating our resources in this time. You know, as a policy, I think actually these folks who have worked 18 months have kind of spent their lives paying into the system, paying taxes, working, being, you know, I think in some senses they do have as much a claim in these really hard times as anybody else. And the other thing I would say to that is that part of this reason that we're getting a huge bump in our federal FMAP is because we have a high unemployment rate. And we're getting additional dollars because Minnesota ranks on the high side of the unemployment rate. The sense that I get from that is one of the things we want to do with this federal stimulus FMAP match, one of the things that the federal government wanted us to do was actually help people who are losing their jobs. That's what this bill is aimed at in a very, I think, targeted way. So again, the people that qualify are people that don't qualify for COBRA or the Minnesota equivalent, unless they have to pay more than 8% of their income. People that don't have other alternatives, so their spouse doesn't have group coverage or they don't qualify for Medicare. People under 275% of poverty. And there's one other one that I'm not thinking of right now, but it's a fairly targeted benefits, but that I think will actually help a group of people who in these tough times need the help. So, and there is a letter there's two letters that I'd like to three points I'd like to refer to. There's a March 9th letter from Debbie and Dan Kirchner from down in Rochester who are, it's a personal story of theirs. There's some information from Ramsey County. He testified at the last one, but this is some updated information. This is not in the packet. All right. And then the MMA has a letter of support that you should have all received. So that is it, Madam Chair, with my presentation.
All right. Thank you, Representative Thiessen. We do have the letter from Debbie and Dan Kirchner.
Yeah, and the point, the Ramsey County folks, is an email. Basically, they said that of their, the survey that they did of their dislocated worker enrollees, so these are people who actually qualified for unemployment. There's people, a lot of people that don't fall into this and are probably hurting as well. 20% didn't have a COBRA option at the time of layoff, so that's some of the folks that we're focusing in on here. And 21.6 indicated they would not be able to pay more than $100 per month based on their benefit package for health care. And they may be another group that still would help out.
Okay, thank you, Representative Thiessen. We have a couple of questions already. Representative Brock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Thiessen, I'm just trying to fit all the amendments together. And I just had a question related to the amendment to the amendment, so the 42A3, and how it fits. Lines 1.15, it's talking about who is eligible. And I'm just wondering, related to the employer-subsidized coverage, if you have an employer who is participating in health insurance, but it's through a high deductible plan or some type of matching, how do those folks get covered under this bill? I'm just not understanding how they relate.
If the employer is paying 50% or more of the premium for the insurance package, then they would. It matches up with what we do with Minnesota Care today. That's what this language is trying to do. And maybe Mr. Chun can explain it. But if they're paying 50% or more of the premium, then this, what this is, it's an exclusion for the spouse. What you're looking at there is if your spouse has employment, then you don't qualify. So this is defining who the kind of policy that wouldn't qualify.
Okay.
So if your spouse's employer is paying less than 50% for a family policy, then you would still qualify.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. And Madam Chair, just
Representative
quick follow-up. Thank you. Representative Thiessen, how does this, the amendments, do they change the, help me understand the hospital limit. I understand that it's waived for a certain group of people. Will there be inequity within Minnesota Care then, with some folks having a limit and some folks not having a limit other than just children?
There is, Madam Chair and
Representative
Broad, is the benefit package. I think there's some adults that fall under 175% of poverty, if I'm not mistaken, that actually don't have the hospital cap. So we're using that benefit set. So it would be the kids and adults under 175% of poverty benefit set.
So it aligns it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this aligns with one kind. I mean, there's other people that don't. Right. But, yeah.
Okay. We have Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, I appreciate the changes to the bill. I know the last time we talked about this bill, I had brought up the idea of a voucher and how much simpler it might be to simply help these people by giving them a buy-down on the cost of purchasing their own policy, something they could take with them that would have portability rather than moving them from COBRA or whatever else. I realize you've excluded COBRA-eligible people now under this rate. Why not go that route? Why not try a voucher approach where we simply buy down the cost of private market insurance?
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair and Representative Gottwald, I think that's a fair question. I think this is administratively simpler in some sense. This only also lasts 2 years. So this is kind of setting up a new program, but it's not as much of a new program, for instance, as that would be. And the second thing is, you know, it depends on where you go when it gets the insurance and what your pre-existing conditions are and a variety of things. On the affordability issue, you know, it's a fair debate to have. This is the direction I chose to go. But part of it is the administrative cost and whether we want to set up a new program for 2 years.
Okay. Representative Bond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, a couple clarification questions. Back to the broad question, I'm a little confused as to why we would treat these folks more generously than the people we already have in Minnesota Care who are paying premiums and who fall under that hospital cap in the 175 to 275 range. not only do they experience the hospital cap, but they also, I assume, may be disenrolled if they don't pay their premiums, where this group's not going to be. So I just want clarity on why we would differentiate between those two groups in the hospital cap, and I have some couple other questions.
Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, on the disenrollment piece first, the way this bill was originally drafted was actually not to have premiums for those 4.5 months, kind of as an emergency kind of piece of this. This just makes it easier for the to do it this way makes it easier for DHS to program their computers. So basically, we're saying you don't have to pay premiums. Okay. So, and the reason for that choice was, A, most of these people are going to be making, if they qualify now, especially if they, because it excludes people with spousal coverage, that they would, the premiums probably wouldn't amount to that much at this point anyway. And it's only for 4.5 months. And so the second point on the hospital cap, you know, I think we're choosing between a group that, I think some of these people will fall below 175%, some of these people will fall above 175%. I mean, remember that the unemployment benefit is about $1,100 a month. So more people actually, I think, would probably fall under the less than 175% of poverty, where they would actually get the hospital cap doesn't exist today.
Representative Bunn, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I have a more broader fundamental question. Maybe I don't understand quite who this group is yet. It strikes me that it appears that this group is folks who have become unemployed who did not previously have any insurance when they were employed, either did not opt to take the employer offered because it was too expensive for them to do, or felt it was too expensive to do, or seek out any private insurance that they didn't find to cover themselves. Am I wrong in that understanding, or is that the group we now are targeting because of the exemption from the COBRA?
Madam Chair and Representative Bunn, I think you are wrong. I think that is a group that could qualify for under this.
Who else?
It also would be people where the COBRA is more than 8% of their income. And it also is people who have private insurance, who chose actually to go out on the individual market and get private insurance, but they don't qualify for COBRA. So it would be those three groups that you'd be, that this would be targeted at.
Representative Bunn?
A clarifying question then, because you just mentioned the 8% with the COBRA. Now that we have the federal, I believe it was 65% of the COBRA would be covered, how does that factor into whether they meet the 8%?
It's 35, it's their share.
If the 35 is still 8%?
Yeah.
Do we have numbers on how many people would we have?
I don't right now.
But that's your understanding of how it would work?
That's how it would work in the bill.
Yeah.
Okay.
Their share.
All right. Representative, I have a question.
Yes.
Under your bill, for example, this group where the COBRA is more than 8% of their income, under your bill, that group, instead of using the COBRA, comes under your bill where we're not getting the federal match for the COBRA. Am I correct in that?
Madam Chair, they would go into Minnesota. They still get the federal match that we get for Minnesota care, but they wouldn't be taking advantage of the 65% COBRA subsidy. That's correct.
All right. So, Representative Thiessen, then, have you thought about a different scenario where we would, because in the case of these people who are eligible for the federal COBRA subsidy but aren't able to take advantage of it because it's too expensive for them anyway, if we don't help them pay for it, we're just essentially leaving that money on the table. Am I right? Whereas if we instead targeted some of this money to pay some more of that COBRA for them, we would be picking up the federal match. Am I right about that?
Madam Chair, you would be. And I have honestly gone back and forth about whether to do anything with those COBRA folks at all. But that would be that's an alternative that we haven't explored fully yet. But you're right.
Okay. Other questions, members?
And I certainly, we can explore that, too. I mean, I think that's you've raised a good, important point.
Representative Norton and then Ablis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would appreciate you exploring that a little bit further, I think. And I may be wrong on this, but I'm just going to throw this out there, and if I'm wrong, please correct me. But I believe Minnesota Care is running out of funding in 2013. I don't see an end date because I think when this originally came up, it was set to be kind of crisis management on something that was occurring now that we had faced because of the national economy and our state's economy. that this was going to handle the immediate crisis, but I didn't see an end date on it, which means this will go into perpetuity, and I guess I'm wondering how we're going to manage the funding, but maybe I'm misreading it or not finding that.
Madam Chair and Representative Norton, I think we also had a small business Minnesota care piece in here, and we deleted that section, and I think we also deleted the sunset date. So the intent of this is actually to sunset in 2 years. I'm just looking through it now. I didn't see that.
Well, I didn't see it either, so if you could put that back in there, that would have been
Mr. Chun maybe has an answer, though.
Into the future.
Mr. and Mr. Norton, I believe that the sunset date is still in the bill on page 5, line 5. So we deleted section 3 below that, but we kept the effective date. I'm sorry, we kept the expiration date, which is on page 5, line 4, I should say.
July 1st, 2011.
Okay. Representative Abler.
Thanks. I've been rereading this bill. It's actually come a long ways. I've done a lot of work on it since last time, and you've probably learned a lot about unemployment law. This is really just waiving the 4-month limit. Basically, in a roundabout with all kinds of exclusions, and that made
that's the essence of it. Madam Chair.
Representative Keith.
So I have a couple questions, and I
all right, Representative Abler.
Somebody, Representative Bonner, somebody said, why do you need the increased services for the hospitals, which I would predict as this moves along will fall back to the normal level if this goes anywhere. And another thing is, just on a logistical basis, and I can kind of see some of the value of this bill compared to before. It solves some people in crisis. But on 4.8, it talks about the people don't do it through PMAP, they do it through fee-for-service. And would they go to any MA provider then, and then bill under MA rules? Is that the logistics of it?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, yeah, and this is how it was in the original bill as well. But they would go to any, some would have to be MA qualified, and then they would pay through that fee-for-service system. The thought being, if people are going to come on for 4 months, why are we going to pay a capitated for 4 months when they might not use anything?
And I realize this is the last question for now. I realize this is not the finest. Do you have an idea about how many people and what this is going
to
cost?
We're still trying to figure that. I mean,
ballpark?
We have actually, I mean, this is narrowed down even in the last 3 days. So
right.
We'll find out.
Yeah. All right. We have a testifier on your bill. There are no other questions for Representative Thiessen right now. Let's move to the testifier. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bartsch, represent Health Partners. I believe I'm also here today on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I want to thank the office.
You're not sure?
You don't know what you want to
say. Yeah, I think something like that. No. No, Madam Chair, I am here on their behalf.
Thank you.
It's them probably questioning that more than me. I appreciate the author's willingness to talk with us about this bill. There have been a number of changes that we think improve it, particularly the elimination of the Minnesota Care for Small Employers. There is one piece I do want to draw the committee's attention to and raise a concern about, and that is on line 2.29. This new language would essentially create a guarantee issue for people who roll off of temporary Minnesota Care. I think this committee in the last couple of years has had a number of discussions about guarantee issue and how that mechanism as a standalone in the individual market can lead to adverse selection. While I understand that this is meant to affect a relatively small number of people, I still believe there's some opportunity for adverse selection. I also question why we're setting, one, a precedent for this action through this bill, and then also why it is that this particular group of people would have access to this benefit, whereas the rest of the population would not. I think the committee has had a thorough discussion, at least what I've heard, about some of the other issues in the bill. So I just wanted to raise that point with the committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bartsch. I think we have a question from Representative Abler.
Well, Mr. Bartsch, I'd be happy to offer an oral amendment to extend this guaranteed issue to the whole market. I think we could get it crafted pretty quickly if you'd think it'd be more fair. Just trying to help. I have a real question for you, though. As a provider, you'd rather have people in the private market than in Minnesota Care, wouldn't you? And so is this a positive, is there a positive element to this you see of those who could actually afford one of your regular market plans? Or do you carry it away as a, in the wearing any of your hats?
Madam Chair, Representative Daly, are you speaking specifically to this piece?
Yeah, to the page 2 one, you talked about your concern on the guaranteed issue, and this gets people into a private plan, which I think is appealing to me, and I think the market is narrow, as was suggested by both of you. And these are people in harm's way that would otherwise have to be an MCHAR or something, which they would never afford, and they'd wind up falling back on the state in some other way or just at the ER. So do you see some positives in that? I guess that's my, I'll shrink it down to one question. Is there somewhere to go with this, do you think?
Mr. Barr.
Madam Chair and Representative Abel, we think everyone should be covered first and foremost. But to the extent that this sets a precedent in a different option than from the rest of the market, we have some concerns. And also, anytime you're guaranteeing coverage to sick population in the individual market, that can have an adverse effect on the overall rating for that individual market. So you may see coverage for some of these people, but what you will see is higher rates, and you may see a loss of coverage for other people. Again, this is meant to be a limited number of people, so we can debate what the extent to which that phenomenon would occur, but it's setting that precedent in case. I would also like to make you aware that you mentioned the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. That is an available option to people who are denied coverage in the individual market.
All right, other questions, members? Okay, seeing none. Okay, Representative Peterson.
Yeah, and just on the last point, I mean, I think that there is this issue of the precedent. I think the adverse effects, because this is a largely randomly selected group, you don't know if they're going to be sicker or not. I'm not sure it's such a concern. And, you know, the rationale for it is people that are eligible for COBRA, you know, they do get this on a guaranteed issue basis, and so that when they expire from their COBRA. So I'm trying to, in some sense, bring equity to some people that don't otherwise have it.
Okay, and members, I also want to remind you that this is headed to finance, so this will not be a question.
Ultimately, well, it's going to Mahoney first and then to finance, yes.
Okay. Well, I think it has to pass through.
Bioscience and workforce.
It has to pass through finance.
Yes.
And so.
Yes.
But anyway, this is not its last stop.
Not by any means.
Right. So, okay. So, Representative Peterson renews his motion that House File 42, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion passes. The bill is passed.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 1141 be recommended as passed and sent to the General Register.
Okay, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chairman, I have Dr. Jonathan Chorn here to talk about this bill, but basically what it does is set the length that a prescription for contact lenses can be given. In Minnesota, currently it could be 2 years. And then the federal law recommends 1 year. And since, unlike glasses that... well, they have to help you see, you don't have much contact with your eyes. With contact lenses, they're right on your eye, and if they don't fit right, they can cause serious problems. So what this bill does is basically is just say that the puts us in compliance with federal law that contact lenses prescriptions last 1 year. And Dr. Jonathan Chorn is here to... talk a little bit about the bill, briefly.
Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jonathan Chorn. I'm an optometrist in Apple Valley, and I'm representing the Minnesota Optometric Association here today. And as Representative Huntley said, the need for this bill is really to simply bring us into compliance here with the federal contact lens law by setting maximum expiration date for a contact lens prescription at 1 year. Federal law was passed after the state law was passed, and the difference has created confusion amongst the public, amongst the providers, as well as contact lens sellers across the country. So along with that, the standard of care for contact lens patients is to be seen on a yearly basis, and this is pretty much the case across the country. We're one of the handful of states that has contact lens prescription expiration date in excess of the 1 year, and as we said, the federal law is set at 1 year. Both ophthalmologists and optometrists agree that this standard of care of 1 year is best for the patients, and both groups have met and agree that this bill is in the best interest of patients at this time. Think of a pharmaceutical prescription. You wouldn't think of having that have an expiration longer than 1 year, and the contact lens acts in contact with the eye to have adverse reactions just as a pharmaceutical can. I always talk to my patients about the cornea, the front window of the eye, being kind of like the windshield in the car. And if you can't see out through that, you're not going to be able to get down the road. And so if you get the scratches or pits in that windshield, you replace that, but you can't really replace your cornea. And the contact lens can have adverse reactions, causing sometimes a corneal ulcer, sometimes new blood vessel growth onto that cornea. And so it's my job on a daily basis to evaluate and make sure that the contact lens is fitting correctly. And if patients are confused as to whether they're supposed to come and see me at a year or if they're coming longer than that, it makes it much more difficult for us to care for our patients. And so what we're trying to do is simply get this law passed so that we can follow the national standard and clarify single clinical statutory standards.
Any questions? Representative Norton.
Just out of curiosity, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do insurance companies, whether they be state or private, cover those physician visits as part of their coverage?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, the many insurance panels cover yearly eye exams, and so this wouldn't, I don't believe, impact any patients adversely from a financial standpoint.
Representative Moffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just thinking this through, I know we have to conform to federal law, but as someone who's legally blind without my glasses, if I hadn't been in for a year, does that mean I can, and I need to get replacement glasses to drive to work, can I get those still with the expired prescription?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. This is not in relation to glasses prescription at all. This is only to a contact lens prescription. Glasses prescriptions do not have any contact with the surface of the eye, and they aren't going to cause any adverse reactions. Whereas the contact lens being in contact with the eye could cause some of those issues that I mentioned. And so basically, if this contact lens law is changed, then it's true that after 1 year, a patient could not get a new supply of contact lenses without getting an exam. But this does not relate at all to the glasses prescription. So.
And I've got an emergency pair. So, in the past. So, you probably can get it just for a short time. Representative Cotwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hundley and testifier. I guess I was a little curious about this one as well. I too am legally blind without my glasses, and I also wear contacts, but I get where a provider, by being able to do this more often than once every 2 years or whatever, obviously that'd be a financial benefit to them, but my eyes have not changed much over the last several years. They're very stable. That's what my optometrist has told me. And so there shouldn't really be a need for me, as long as I'm following the directions with contact lenses, not wearing them too long, throwing them away, using the disposables on a regular basis. It would be an inconvenience and an added expense for me to go back every year when they're in fact the same and find out that my prescription hasn't changed, but now I've got a new get out of jail free card and can go get my contacts again. So I'm a little puzzled. My understanding is, as long as I follow, the guidelines there, I should be just fine under the current requirements. So help me understand again why this is a good thing when we're trying to save money and provide convenience to patients like myself who have glasses and contacts.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. The concern is not so much the patients that are following the rules, and certainly a good percentage do, but I find in my own personal experience, a large percentage of people, I will explain to them sort of what they're supposed to do. They come back the next year, they're not following those rules, and I've seen corneal changes then occur because of that. And so the idea is we want to be able to better monitor those patients before they have visual loss that could lead to some deficit in the future. And so That's the concern. It's a challenge between how we explain this to the patients, what they're hearing, and what they're hearing maybe from a contact lens seller out elsewhere.
Where's it go?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, my understanding again is if you don't follow those directions, even in the very near term, a couple weeks, maybe a month, you could do some significant damage in a very near term. So I mean, if that's the concern, you really ought to make this maybe every 30 days. Not that I'm suggesting that.
Representative Holly, this is federal law requires this right 1 year right now. We're just conforming with that, right? So you don't really have any choice, is that correct, about doing it every year?
Mr. Chair, at this point, because the state law says 2 years, what the state law actually says is that we're allowed to prescribe it at a less time if we feel that is in the best interest of the patient. So the challenge is I've got a lot of colleagues who are having to write out the instructions as to why they're requesting the 1 year for the patient. The patient's getting confused, and they're saying, well, the federal says one, but the state says two. We're trying to just simply clarify that. And, again, it goes back to the standard of care. Across the country, the standard of care between all pretty much all eye care providers is to see that patient on a 1 year basis.
Any other questions? Representative Bunn, no? Oh, okay. All right. So, any other discussion? Seeing none. Representative Huntley's going to renew his motion that House File 1141 be recommended pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee, and this is the highlight of my political career. I got the ophthalmologist and optometrist to agree on something.
Representative Stern, I will move that House File 782 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Chair.
And there's also an amendment?
Yes, there is. The House File 782 should have I'd like to amend the 782 with delete everything amendment. Here,
right.
Where it should be in your packet there.
I will move the 103 amendment.
Okay.
And this is to get the bill in the form you want it?
That is correct.
All right. Any discussion on that? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Representative Stern.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Tisa. I'm just presenting today a bill with a sudden infant death and shaken baby syndrome for care that would amend it to all preschool children up to the age of 5. And I brought with me some testifiers that can help me with the testimony of that before you. So I appreciate. So here with me I have is Stan Groff with the Minnesota Social Service Association and Jerry Kerber with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, as well as a couple other testifiers after these. So if I could just maybe
that's great.
Go to them. Okay, thank you. Stan, would you care to go for
Mr. Groff?
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Stan Groff, and I represent the Minnesota Social Service Association. Briefly, House File 782 is a bill that requires training for staff who care for infants and young children and specifies that the training component include instruction on reducing the risk of sudden infant death syndrome and shaken baby syndrome for infants and young children up to and including age 5. It covers licensed foster care homes, chemical dependency treatment programs serving infants and small children, obviously the parents thereof, family child care centers, and corporate child care centers. The fix that this bill makes is that there are gaps in the law, there are age differences in the law among the various providers. In some parts you see a maximum of 6 months, training for 18 months, and some practices up to 5 years, but there's no uniformity. This provides clarity and uniformity in the law, and it expands the number of covered children to include all children up to age 5 in these 4 types of facilities. I'll stop there and take any questions that you might have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
President Dowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, can you explain to me why we're expanding this? What's the main reason behind this? Is it that we have new science that tells us that that we need to go further to 5 years of age, or
Mr. Graff?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative. Yes, experientially, we're finding that children over the age that are now covered in the law have been subject to child abuse through the shaking of these small children, And so a three-year-old, for example, or a four-year-old, or even a five-year-old can easily be shaken by a provider who may not know his or her own cues about when they're losing it or getting angry. So, yeah. And so this is just prevention at no cost.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is basically training these people are already having to go through, and it's simply explicitly increasing the age. So I suppose if you were somebody who was delivering services to somebody who's 3 years of age, you wouldn't currently receive this training. Now you might have to include it. Is that kind of the thinking?
Mr. Kopp.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you have hit the nail right on the head. That's exactly right.
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the director of the licensing division. And I just want to thank Representative Turner for accepting our friendly amendment here that just sort of changes the format of the bill a little bit in technical ways. The first section of the bill talks about, of the amendment now, talks about child foster care providers. The second section talks about children's residential facilities that serve infants and young children. The third part of the bill talks about child care centers, and then the last part is for family child care providers. So the amendment doesn't change what's intended here in the bill. It just uses different terminology to make it more clear.
Any questions for the front row and abroad?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Kerber, does this include then preschools?
Mr. Chair and Representative Broad, preschool programs, it covers kids up to school age. And so preschool programs would not be included in this. Let me think for a second. Preschool. No, so a school age, the definition of school age in child care settings is if they're eligible to start kindergarten. And so school age, preschools are before kindergarten in many settings. So it would not include preschool.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That seems backward to me.
It would include.
Mr. Chair, let me correct myself. Yes, it would include school preschool programs. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Excuse me.
Any other discussion or questions for this witness?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to know, is there scientific evidence that children up to 5 years of age can be subject to shaken baby syndrome? And I have to tell you, the reason I'm asking is that, you know, I have some experience dealing with this, and I actually have actually read the scientific data on this quite extensively. And I think this is an area that is fraught with disagreement among the experts, and especially as my understanding of shaken baby is that the theory behind it, and there's even questions of whether it occurs at all, I have to tell you, but the theory, I think, is that in younger children, because their muscles are very weak in their neck and because of their head relative to their size and all of that, that these kinds of injuries can occur, but that as a child gets older, that it becomes perhaps impossible to do that kind of injury with that kind of conduct. And so I'm just wondering, you know, this, we're kind of in this bill, I realize we're not making an enormous policy change based on this, you know, but we are kind of, if we pass this, we're kind of putting into law this sort of assumption that this injury actually occurs from this kind of conduct. And I wonder if you have,
Representative Liebling,
I don't want to open an enormous can of worms on it, but I think we need to consider that.
Chair Thiessen and Representative Liebling, I do have two other testifiers too. I do have a reporter from you from the American Academy of Pediatrics and other institutes that could even affect children up to the age of 8, but my professor next to me would be more apt to answer that. So I have Michelle Gray with the Brain Injury Association of Minnesota, and Kim King with PACER, kind of to my left here. So thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I think I'll defer a couple of the questions first to Kim King. I was going to give my testimony first, but I will let Kim King please.
Okay. For the record, my name is Kim King. I am the public policy director of PACER, and I'm actually the mother of a shaken baby syndrome survivor.
And I started a nonprofit called the Shaken Baby Alliance in 1998 in the state of Texas. It's a national nonprofit that focuses on prevention, family support, and criminal prosecution around this particular issue. So it's something that I've spent probably the past 12 to 13 years going around the United States with professionals, offering a parent perspective. And certainly the first thing I think I want to do is hand out, there's an article from the American Academy of Pediatrics that talks about documented cases of children up to 5 being shaken. So I want to just hand that out right now and then say a few things about that article.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, in terms of the question that Representative Liebling did bring up in terms of the question about children, older children being shaken because they are larger, their muscles are stronger, particularly their neck muscles, typically what I've seen happen in these cases is that older children are usually shaken and they're thrown against a hard object like a wall or something. So you have what we typically call shaken impact syndrome. And I agree there's a lot of controversy around this area. It's been going on for a lot of years. There's not a lot of documentation on cases. But for the older kids, typically we see a shaking and kind of an impact component to the child abuse. It does happen, realizing these children can be 30 to 50 pounds. That's a lot of anger if an adult is taking out on a child. But we have had cases as old as 5. There is one documented case of an 8-year-old where this happened that's been documented by the medical community. So it does happen. I realize there's a lot of controversy around this form of child abuse. Children, very small infants, yes, they can be shaken and this injury can be caused relatively easily. But it does happen to older children. So I guess that would be my commentary on that. And if I could begin my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Okay. First of all, I want to thank Representative Sterner for bringing House File 782 forward. As a parent, I certainly support this bill. Unfortunately, I know firsthand the emotional and financial devastation of shaken baby syndrome, a traumatic brain injury caused by child abuse. My youngest daughter, Rachel, now 13 years old, was shaken at the age of 6 months by a Texas family child care provider. When I was told in an emergency room that Rachel had shaken baby syndrome in 1995, I as a parent had no idea what they were talking about. I thought it was a genetic disorder. I had no idea that this was any form of physical child abuse. Today, thankfully, laws in several states, there's about 13 to 14 states that now have laws, including Minnesota, requiring that new parents at hospitals receive information on shaken baby syndrome, as well as including that foster parents and child care providers receive training. We've come a long way, but certainly as the medical community starts to reveal more information, we need to constantly, I think, update, our trainings that we're providing to these individuals. You should know that today, Rachel's a happy child. She's touched so many lives. She suffers from lifelong disabilities such as seizures, cerebral palsy, blindness, and is at the intellectual level of a 2 to 3-year-old. She is a complicated little girl that takes a lot of time. She attends the Orono Public Schools, and she receives special education services there. Unfortunately, Rachel will be dependent on others for the rest of her life. Her life has forever changed, and shaken baby syndrome has changed our family forever. Mm-hmm. It was a life-changing experience that motivated me to start a national nonprofit that focuses on prevention, family support, and criminal prosecution in 1998 while living in Dallas, Texas. As a result of this, I have presented nationally and internationally on this issue and written several articles. I've talked to distraught family members from across the United States who just found out that their children were shaken, had no idea how to even begin to put together the medical and rehabilitative services for their child. I've talked to those struggling to get through the criminal justice system and see some form of justice. And I've talked to those simply trying to get a grave headstone for their deceased child that they could not get covered in any other way. I've been their advocate, providing resource information, finding expert witnesses, and providing additional information. And yes, I have been involved with families who've had 2-, 3-, and 4-year-olds who have been killed by shaken baby syndrome. Prevention, education, awareness through videos, written materials, and in-services are the most cost-effective way that we can prevent shaken baby syndrome. While around 25% of all children will die from shaken baby syndrome, the remaining survivors have health care costs that reach well into the millions. Right now we've had children where it's cost $5 million upwards to $10 million for a lifetime of health care. That doesn't include special ed costs. That doesn't include having to have a family member stay home like I had to do with my daughter. There are a lot of costs that are not even included. So you can see this form of brain injury can just be totally devastating to a child. Secondly, revising the language to include young children 1 to 5 years of age will prevent young children from being injured during a critical period in their brain development. As we all know, the first 3 years of a child's life is one of tremendous brain development and growth. In fact, 80% of the brain development is in the first 4 years of life. So a devastating brain injury like shaken baby syndrome damages the brain to such an extent before these children have been able to acquire skills that there is really no recovery for them. I think a lot of people believe young children recover from brain injury, you know, better than adults, or they actually fully recover. That's not true. When you don't have the skills to start out with and you have a brain injury, it drastically alters your recovery. So what happens is these children are put on a path that's medically, rehabilitatively, and educationally complex. And lastly, I just want to address the training materials in in-service training, which I hope some components that will be built in that around normal child development with specific focus around key shaking triggers for young children, which include toilet training and temper tantrums. These are very different than a crying infant, which we have a lot of prevention information out in the community for. You know, it is often easy for a frustrated caregiver to perceive a child as having a willful behavior when the child is simply displaying a behavior that's appropriate for them at that stage of development. Lastly, I just want to thank Representative Cerner again and the committee for considering this bill, and I have copies of my testimony, which I will just hand around also. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? You want to wait till after both? Okay. Please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michelle Gray, and I work in public policy at the Brain Injury Association. I'll keep my testimony brief. I just wish to be here and present our organization's strong support for House File 782. The Brain Injury Association of Minnesota is the only statewide nonprofit organization in Minnesota devoted solely to advocating for the estimated 100,000 Minnesotans, to include 12,000 children and young adults who live with a disability due to brain injury. The Brain Injury Association of Minnesota and the Minnesota Department of Health consider shaken baby syndrome as inflicted traumatic brain injury. This preventable form of brain injury comes at a very high cost to infants and young children, considering the life-altering disability that may result, not to mention the financial cost for the lifetime of health care needed upon infliction of a traumatic brain injury. The Brain Injury Association advocates strongly for more expansive awareness and prevention measures. House File 782 is a straightforward effort to expand training to licensed caregivers to include young children as well as infants on the danger and prevention of inflicted traumatic brain injury or shaken baby syndrome. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, sorry. I can go if you want. Okay.
I'm ready now.
So any other? Okay, Reverend Gobble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. By the way, very good cookies for about a minute.
Yeah, who did you bring the? Reverend Stern, thank you. Oh, can you say that?
See, now I feel, you know, I should have waited till after the bill went through and eat the cookie. Okay. Representative Stern, my concern about this is not shaken baby or shaken child syndrome. I think we can all agree that's a bad thing. We ought to be preventing it. We already have required reporting guidelines concerning child abuse. My concern is we're now expanding this, and we're going to involve a number of other entities in training. That's what this bill is really about, is expanding training. And I realize we're not a finance committee, but I do have some concerns about adding another mandate to more providers, and we often hear criticism of that, that we do too much of that. So I think we just need to think about that aspect. This is really about expanding training, not about sanctioning shaken baby situations. I think already in preschools or ECFE situations and others, there would clearly be, if abuse was going on, we'd expect people to report it. We'd expect it not to happen. It would be criminally prosecuted if it was. So again, the question is, do we extend the training? Do we add that expense? Does it make sense for people beyond what we're currently doing? And
Representative Chair and Representative Gottwald, the training asked for just 1 hour every 5 years, which would be half for SIDS and half hour for shaken baby syndrome. So in my feeling, it doesn't feel like a lot to ask.
Are there additional questions? It doesn't look like it. Representative Thiessen renews his motion that House File 782 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Bill is adopted. Next we have House File 849, Hall. I'll move the House File 849 and be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. And Representative Hawks, you have an office amendment?
I do, and it's a delete all amendment, although it's within the same spirit.
Okay, I also move the DE amendment in the form that the author wants, and then we'll discuss it once it's removed. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the DE one is adopted. Representative Hawks, your bill.
Thank you. To the bill, to the amendment. I just want to tell you where this started. I got calls from my citizens in St. Cloud, specifically consumers. And one of the consumers says, I'm getting a 90-day notice, and then they called me back and said, I'm getting a 60-day notice. And then as I looked into it, they would get a 90-day notice, a 60-day notice, a 45-day notice, and a phone call, possibly. And I thought that was a little bit too much. This is, I think, for a notice of service managed care. I know that he has children with special needs that are adults now and living in a home. And I thought, well, why is that? Why are they giving that many notices? And so I asked around for counties and other people, and I had a pretty good consensus of why those were multiple notices, and that's what consensus was, that they might need to have something from the doctor, and they have a little bit of trouble getting a doctor's appointment, and that made an awful lot of sense to me. So then I thought, well, do you all need a 90, a 60, a 45, and a phone call? Well, I didn't think you needed all those, so I dropped it down to two notices, I guess, or now we're down at two notices, and then in the last moment, I got calls from the department, and they said, well, it's not really true that they have that they need doctor's appointments. I said, well, then why do they have this? Why do you have a 90, 60, 45 and a phone call? Well, it's because you got to put documentation together. I said, so then I want some of this knocked out just so we can have documentation. That works for me. Then the question asked to me was, why am I getting all this? Tell me how this makes sense. And I said, well, then we should tell these people why this makes sense. My first statement was, because you may have to go to the doctor, and it's hard for you to get a notice. Well, that was false. So I scratched that out. That's how we got to the amendment. You've got to put a lot of documentation together. Not knowing this, in this process, and sorry to get in your boat, because I imagine it is a small canoe and it looks like it's pretty crowded, the governor knocked everything out. 90, 60, 45, and the phone call is out in the governor's message. Now, I don't know about unintended consequences, and I hope you do. But my daddy said, if you don't know the depth of the water, test it out with 1 foot, not both feet, and don't go real deep. So that's why I put down just a couple of these are gone. And you still have to tell the people why if it's legal to tell them why. And that's the amendment. And I think somewhere along the line, your committee is going to have to make some wise decisions on the usage of the money. And somewhere along here, it appears to me that it's been extrapolated up for really good service. But if you're making cuts the consumers from my area, a few consumers are from my area, saying, please cut the number of these notices out and use the money for the program. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there testifiers out there that want to speak on this before we go to members? I don't see any. The Representative Scottwell.
Thank you, Chair Tal. I'm gonna act as a testifier, but I
thank you. I need one.
When Larry brought this forward, I thought, now here's a bit of smart government. You know, where are we overdoing it for the sake of, as Larry put it, documentation, and where can we simplify things and do a little bit of common sense reform? And this seems to fall in that. Since then, I've also heard from constituents who've described similar things with other processes, and I think at some point it might be beneficial if some of you want to draft some bills. We should look through all these processes and see how much, frankly, wasted paperwork, mailing costs, human resource costs for spending, preparing and sending out mailings and notices for various things that maybe are just a little overdone. Because they not only cost us, but they rob those resources from things that we really need to use them for. So I'm speaking in favor of it. I hope you all vote green.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hodge, you have a good bill. I think it can be better. I think that there's some things that we require of the private market that are somewhat unnecessary and duplicative as well. And so I hope that you'll be open, and it sounds as if you will be, to actually expanding this beyond just the public realm to the private things that we require of those private health plans as well, related to sending out the plans or the documentation about what's covered and things along those lines. We put a lot of requirements on the health plans themselves that now, with the advent of the Internet, we could probably do in a much more efficient way. And so I look forward to working with you to make this good bill even better by bringing it to the private market as well in terms of reduction of regulations and efficiency.
Mr. Chair. If it's the desire of the board that you wish me to move this forward, I would be happy to do that with my personal energy. There's some things in here that I would also change if I was actually going to ride this out a little bit longer. I understand that one of them may be a little bit more difficult to do, and that is the opt-out form may be counterproductive to what we want to be doing. In other words, if we're going to get, that may actually cause more paperwork and it costs more money, and that's what we were trying to avoid, so that may be counterproductive. But if it's the desire of the chair to move this forward in a bill manner, and you want me to work at it and work with some of your committee members, I would be happy to do that.
Representative Haas, I think this bill is probably going to go to finance and will end up in Representative Huntley's committee, and we'll take a look at it, and if it makes sense, Representative Huntley will let you know.
Thank you.
Are there anyone from the DHS that might want to speak on this, or...
Mr. Chair, members, Shannon McMahon from the Healthcare Administration at DHS. Representative Haas is correct. We've actually been working with him on this bill. We spoke with him about it actually this morning. And the governor's budget does include a provision to save $282,000 in this triennium to eliminate the 60-90-day notice and then the managed care call requirement. It does not eliminate the 45-day notice requirement that's actually required under federal law. So we wouldn't be eliminating that notice requirement. These notice requirements were added in 2007. And Representative Haas' comments about the opt-out form are correct. I think it's the department's position that having an opt-out form would probably cause as much, if not more, confusion than we have currently, both in the state and county system with regard to these additional notices. So our recommendation to him in our discussions about this bill was for that language to be removed. But otherwise, we'll certainly work with you and the committee. A similar bill was passed actually in the Senate last night that reflects a similar sentiment.
Ms. McMahon, I know that Representative Haas did this on his own, and you get the investigation and all the good work. Are there stuff, similar stuff, similar to this that we could look at that the department is might be aware of?
Mr. Chair, members, do you mean administrative simplification opportunities?
Sure.
Actually, there are a couple of bills that are moving in the House and the Senate. There's one that I know that the Children and Family Services area have been working closely with committee members on. And then also there's an administrative simplification proposal that's part of the governor's budget with regard to health care program eligibility determinations, too. And the department stands ready to work with the committee on any of these proposals and have met with some members to talk about moving those forward.
Good. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has been answered.
Oh, very good. Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. After these last comments about referring to the governors, you mentioned that a 45-day notice was required under federal law. I thought the choice was between the 60-day that was imposed here and nothing under the governors. Are you seeing that the governors would retain a 45-day notice? And then if that's the case, then Representative Paz, why wouldn't we just go with just only the 45 and not a 60 and 45?
Ms. McMahon or Mr. Hawk, Representative Hawk?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bunn, that's correct. The governor's proposal retains the 45-day notice requirement for mailing of renewal notices to current health care program enrollees.
Representative Hall?
I'm happy if you're going to move this forward. I think the old game you used to play, decide who was first. I think this is a scissors cut paper. And I think it's time that you look at all your programs and reduce those, and I encourage this committee to do so. I was doing this for a citizen, and I'm happy to, if it's your desires for me to move this forward and work with it with Representative Huntley, I'd be happy to do that. Or I'm happy to just know that I've said my piece here and motivated you to do this.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder, Ms. McMahon, if you could just refresh the committee as to why we put those guidelines in place in the first place, those notices. I know I have a constituent who missed a payment, and it started the churning of the process. And so, sometimes people who I don't want to make a blanket statement, but, lives may be chaotic for individuals who are using these programs. So perhaps you could address that.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Ruth, there are two notice requirements, I think, that have gotten maybe combined into this notion here. First, there's the 60-90-day renewal notice requirement that's here in front of the committee now in 256-962, and that's around the actual healthcare program renewal form. And then last year, Representative Rood had a bill that looked at sending an additional renewal notice for folks who are on TEFRA, for children who are on TEFRA. It was actually Representative Norton, so I apologize, I stand corrected. But that was also to give folks who had children on TEFRA an additional notice just as a heads up that your TEFRA or your disability determination was coming due. And so there are two, I think, intertwined issues in this bill that you might be addressing with your comments. But when this was enacted in 2007, the notion was precisely what you said, Representative Rood, that it was just an additional notice. Hey, just a heads up, your eligibility determination is coming. And I think what we have found is that it has actually caused further confusion where folks have gathered information, gathered financial information, perhaps even in some cases gathered health care information that isn't timely enough for an eligibility worker to process somebody's renewal. In addition, it's prompted a lot of phone calls to both the Minnesota Care Operations Center, the counties, that have just prompted additional confusion where enrollees have gotten to the point where they just sent their renewal in almost 6 months early at times just to make sure that they're keeping on top of things. So, and we can certainly share with the committee a schedule of what the renewal notice mailings look like right now, but there are folks who are getting renewals as much as you know, 4 months before the point where they'd actually have to turn something in to the state or to the county.
Representative Norton.
Well, I was going to ask this earlier, and then I decided I didn't want to bother Representative Hawes because I was sure he didn't know about it. But now that you've brought it up, thank you. It sounds like this might affect the TEFRA change we put in last year, and I will say I have seen a copy of the letter that was sent out, and I am not surprised people are confused because it was not clear that they were not to get their appointment immediately. And so if you change this, we are going to be back to where we were, and in fact in worse shape, for families of children who need to make appointments for TEFRA determination, which often take months and months to get doctor's appointments in order to prove their eligibility again. And so while I understand what you're trying to do, and I support the reduction of paperwork and the number of letters, for TEFRA families, I believe there is a difference, and the letter that went out was inadequate and does need to be changed, or you are going to get people sending things in early because they still had to qualify within the 3 month period of time prior to their determination and not earlier when they were getting that notice. So I understand that the problems occurred, but I would say it was in how it was handled, not the fact that they got the letter early. And so, Representative Hawes, if you're going to move this forward, I am going to want some language on there that would take TEFRA families off of this, because I do believe they have a very unique situation in their determination.
Representative Hawes, get final words, and then we're going to wrap it up.
Again, I will do what the committee wishes me to do. Obviously, you see room for improvement. If you want me to be working on it or you want your committee members to work on it, let me know. I'd be happy to apply my energy, but I don't feel it's necessary that I do it, but I think it's necessary that somebody does it. Thank you.
Okay. The chair renews his motion that House File 849, as amended, be recommended pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the bill is adopted. Thank you, Representative Hall. Next, House File 491, Representative Liebland. Representative Liebland moves that House File 491 be recommended passed and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Liebland, do you care to move your author's amendment?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the DE-1 amendment.
Okay, Representative Liebland moves the DE-1 amendment. I believe that's a delete all amendment. Or is it?
Yes.
And put in the shape that the author wants, and after that we'll discuss the bill as adopted. So all those in favor of the DE-1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. The ayes carry. The amendment is adopted. Representative Liebland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, this bill is, we could refer to it as a data mining bill. And members, what many people in Minnesota, even many physicians, are not aware that prescription information is sold. And when you get a prescription filled, the information goes into a database and is eventually sold, and after a long and complex process can get matched up, what the physician is prescribing gets matched up with other information identifying the prescription, and then pharmaceutical companies eventually use this information in their marketing to physicians in what we call detailing. And what this bill attempts to do is, in a very focused way, to limit the use of that data so that it would prohibit that data being used for marketing. The data is also used for lots of other purposes, and the bill is very carefully tailored not to impact those other purposes, just to restrict the use for marketing. The reason that this bill is coming forward is because of the concern primarily of the cost increases for brand name drugs for drugs that comes from this marketing. One of the things that you need to know is that the pharmaceutical industry spends billions of dollars doing this marketing. So we may hear later on that this isn't effective, but of course I think that the amount of money that's spent on it kind of speaks to how very effective it is as a marketing tool. To get started here, I would just like to read you a little bit from a from a court case. The state of New Hampshire has passed very similar legislation very recently. It is now in effect. I think it went into effect just like last month. But this was challenged in court. It's been upheld by the Federal Circuit Court in that area, the First Circuit Court of Appeals, and in a very, I think, a very well-written opinion. And they have in here a very good description of what the detailers do. And I'm going to just read that to you briefly, and then I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers here to continue the discussion. Once inside a physician's office, detailers are capable of mounting an impressively sophisticated and intense marketing pitch. The detailer works to establish an ongoing relationship with the physician, and in most cases, detailers' visits become a regular occurrence. For example, the average primary care physician interacts with no fewer than 28 detailers each week, and the average specialist interacts with 14. Given the frequency of these exchanges, it is not surprising that prescriber identifiable information can be an invaluable asset to the detailer. The information enables the detailer to zero in on physicians who regularly prescribe competitors' drugs, physicians who are prescribing large quantities of drugs for particular conditions, and early adopters, physicians who have demonstrated openness to prescribing drugs that have just come into the market. The information also allows the detailer to tailor her promotional message in light of the physician's prescribing history. So that just gives you a brief beginning understanding of how this information is being used. And so, members, I would like to introduce my first testifier, Greg Beaumont, and he will introduce himself for the record and let you know what his how this how are you interested in this bill?
Okay, members, here's how we're going to move forward. We're going to have all the testifiers, the for and against, and then we'll take questions after the testimony. So, Mr. Beaumont.
Yes, I've been asked to just talk a few minutes about my basic experience having worked as a detail rep in the past.
State your name for the record, who you're with.
For the record, my name is Greg Beaumont, and... Okay. All right. Well, I worked in the pharmaceutical industry from 1999 through 2006, so for the record, it should be noted that there may have been a few changes to the way that standard operating procedure works since 2006. My experience was with three different companies, and I had several contacts within the industry, so I feel that the information I'll be giving you here today is in no way speculative and is based on firsthand experience. Currently, I'm a project manager for an IT consulting firm, so I am completely removed from the industry and no longer have any ties to it whatsoever. I also have some experience with data mining with databases, so I think that that's relevant to this particular topic. Basically, all representatives have access to prescriber-level data, which means that they get weekly, monthly, quarterly, yearly reports on the specific medications that every single physician in the state of Minnesota is writing. The only exceptions are that there are certain pharmacies which do not report this data. When I was in the industry, for example, Health Partners Pharmacies did not report this data, and Walmart also did not actually report physician-level data. And this data is specific to drug class, what type of drug, what the manufacturer of the product was, the dosage strength, and also the number of days that were prescribed for that particular prescription. So, for example, if it were an antibiotic product, you could tell if it was a 7-day or a 14-day prescription. Additionally, it was distinguished between whether it was a new prescription and a refill, so that it could be determined if the majority of these prescriptions being filled for a physician were prescriptions which were previously written and are being refilled on a recurring basis, whether they are new prescriptions. There were IT tracking systems which would monitor the trend of prescribing, the volumes, and it would also rank physicians based upon what they wrote and the volumes of what they wrote. And basically, it would also be used to do aggregates that would be able to target specific clinics, zip codes, and cities so that effectively you could schedule your detailing route based around where the greatest potential for increased business would be. Additionally, the messaging was very specific to prescription habits. Effectively, detail reps are not so much sales reps as they are vehicles for relaying marketing messages. So effectively, you're told specifically what to say to each physician based upon their prescribing habits. And also, the distribution of free samples is based upon the data which is collected from the pharmacies. So the free samples are used as a tool to get into the clinic because typically they like having them to distribute to patients. And the compromise is they have to listen to the marketing message, which is brought along with it. And that message is, as I mentioned before, tailored to specific prescribing trends. Also, the distribution of samples and signatures is analyzed by management. That's something which is used to ensure that samples are going to the physicians with the greatest profit potential for the company. And effectively, your entire day is planned around that prescribing information. So I think I went a little bit over my time here, but I'll hand it on over to Pete.
Okay. Well, thank you. And now I'm going to ask my next witness, Mr. Wyckoff, to talk a little bit more about the problem and about the bill.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and you may continue.
Good afternoon. My name is Peter Wyckoff. I've actually been around Minnesota for quite a while. I was the founder of the Minnesota Senior Federation, the Metropolitan Senior Federation, for about 30 years. So I aged in place. Retired at the end of 2006 and got picked up on waivers by the Prescription Project, which is an exciting, terribly exciting project funded by Pew Charitable Trust. More and more, as more research comes out, the conflicts within the medical profession that are damaging both the quality and increasing the cost of that profession are becoming more and more evident. And so the goal of the Prescription Project, as we got engaged with it, is really to try to encourage the prescribing of the safest and most effective medication based on the best clinical evidence, as opposed, if you will, to the marketing of the pharmaceutical industry, in this case, on the medical profession. You and I get hit daily with ads. Roughly $4.5 billion is being spent to direct consumer advertising in 2006 by the pharmaceutical companies to you and I as consumers. Over $12 billion is being spent to influence your doctor's behavior. There are over 100,000 sales reps, detail people, all of whom want to sell products, meaning one for every 8 doctors in the United States are out there right now. This does get close to home. As Greg pointed out, he left the profession in 2006, I think partially because of ethical reasons, and in direction. I, last night, had a drug detail person who's a dear friend crying on my shoulder because of the pressure upon her to get out and push their products in local clinics here in the Twin Cities. She fits the norm. She's great in relationship building, of dispensing information, and one of the biggest tools she has, which I think she's beginning to have pauses about, is knowing exactly what that doctor is prescribing. So they can encourage that doctor to prescribe more of that product, or if they're not prescribing that particular company's product to prescribe what that company is doing. The results have shown to be roughly a 17% increase in the cost of pharmaceuticals directly because of that transfer of information, which is coming at the insistence of retailers to the medical profession. Now, this has been a real concern, and doctors, you know, again, hardly know what happened. Drug detailing has been around since 1993. Prescription data mining has been around since 1993. But the evidence of that is most physicians are unaware it's happening. As that detail person enters that examining room, if you will, in that doctor's office, to know exactly what that doctor is prescribing so they can get or encourage the prescribing of that particular drug. They're not going to be there prescribing generics. They are not going necessarily prescribe drugs that, you know, may do the job much better, but it's made by a different manufacturer. It's just not the alliance. There's increasing recognition of this by the medical profession. And I'm proud to say the Minnesota Medical Association has gone on record now in support of this legislation as a needed tool. They and other medical associations are working closely at this point to try to get the American Medical Association to change its area, because the American Medical Association is conflicted in this area. $44 million goes annually from the pharmaceutical industry to the AMA in order to turn over their master files of all the doctors in this country, in this issue. And so they find ways to try to get around this situation.
And so they will provide, and I know there will be terrier, the way to deal with this kind of issue when it happens is to allow doctors to opt out. According to the documents and testimony today, there are 1.4 million prescribers out there, of which 21,000 have figured out how to opt out, and it's a terribly weak opt-out. If you look at the data and the material I have sent you that deals with some of the facts dealing with Minnesota, I think you can deal with this issue. I just want to touch on those specifically, and we can deal with the specific legislation.
1 second. Mr. Chair, did the committee members get those packets?
I believe that, though.
Yeah.
My testimony. My testimony is on top of that. Okay, thank you. Again, legislation has been seen to be terrible, really effective. Drug researchers are really the issues that are doing research pharmaceuticals really have found better ways because many of the areas, and you only get areas as far as the research is available from these drug information firms. They are also cost prohibitive to researchers. There's very limited time for them for non-marketing purposes. IMS, which is one of the people who filed suit in New Hampshire, the largest aggregator, sales to the pharmaceutical industry accounted for substantially all our revenue. In 2006, that was $1.96 billion that all of us pay for. There's a deal with patient safety. They will argue at one point that the way that detail people can get to this is patient safety. You can look at the information that I have at this point that are far, that's the role of the FDA, it's the role of the of local pharmacies to be able to get that safety information out there. They need to be alert to all alerts and not simply the ones that they have prescriber information on. Recent court ruling against Purdue Pharma found that they have intentionally misled doctors about the efficacy of powerful Narcan OxyContin, all the while in possession of prescribers' physician data. So it's around these areas that you are called upon to begin a process of trying to increase the safety of drug supply that is going to this country, to increase the quality of the prescribing that's coming out of doctors' offices, to reduce the cost of unnecessary drugs that is happening. And this bill begins to address all that. Representative Liebling will be sponsoring other additional legislation as part of that whole mix. But this is beginning to start an effort. The New England states have all passed it. The courts have now upheld it. New Hampshire has now begun implementing it. And so we need to find a way. The pharmaceutical companies are important pieces in this country, but they need to make their money off the best research producing the best product as opposed to spending two and three times what they do on research, on marketing, and twice as much of that to directly to doctors than they do for you and I as prescribers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wyckoff. We do have three testifiers in opposition to... We'll take all the questions after all the testimonies at one point, unless you have clarification. Yeah, Representative Ross.
Well, thank you. Just to that specific point related to the courts, it was mentioned that the courts have upheld it, but it's my understanding, and hopefully one of our testifiers who will come in, is that the litigation is certainly not over. So while one court may have upheld or a number of courts, litigation continues, and I think that was a point that needed to
make. As of this day, if I can
Mr. Wyckoff?
Yes. As of this day, the appeals court has unanimously approved it. It's been implemented. The attempt by these companies to stop the implementation has failed. They have until the 16th of April, I believe, to file an appeal to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Now, whether they will, I honestly don't know yet. And secondly, whether the Supreme Court is probably very unlikely to pick it up, given this is really a state issue.
Yes, so it is still ongoing. Could I have the three testifiers all come together at the same time? Ms. Betts, Mr. Rowan, and Nuri. Ms. Betts, state your name for the record, and you may start.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Betts. I'm a Vice President of Government Affairs for Walters Kluwer Health, one of the data mining companies that we're talking about today. I relish the chance to talk to you in the hour after lunch because I think what I have to tell you will help you digest some of the information a little bit easier. We have, I'm happy to be here today, and also I will say at the outset that we have every intention of pursuing this case with the Supreme Court. We have every intention of filing a writ of, a petition for writ of certiorari by the end of this month. Walter Kluwer is in the information business. We deal in business intelligence. We're a leading multinational publishing and information services company active in many markets, including the sale of healthcare products. One division, which is Walters Kluwer Health, is a leading provider of information and business intelligence for students, professionals, and institutions in medicine, nursing, allied health, pharmacy, and the pharmaceutical industry. We publish textbooks, reference products, journals, and other information materials that professionals employ in the knowledge-intensive, rapidly changing practice that we know of medicine. Major brands include software created by Minneapolis-based Provation Medical, a product that they produce helps physicians use for procedure and coding that result in efficiencies and improved patient care. Our primary interest in preserving our critical data assets and the flow of information which our nation will need to face the serious healthcare challenges ahead. Walters Kluwer Health is concerned that is written, the bill before us today will decrease the flow of information in Minnesota and beyond. The bill will eliminate many beneficial uses of physician prescribing information and will have unintended consequences that will ultimately hurt patients in the state. We strongly believe that more information, not less, is appropriate public policy. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to comment just on four issues that have been mentioned during the debate over data restrictions: privacy, cost, physician choice, and public policy. Now, protecting patient privacy in the digital age is not only possible but necessary to ensure confidentiality while also enabling the essential unimpeded flow of information for quality health care, patient safety, and medical research. Federal law provides strong protection of personal health information through the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or as we all know it as HIPAA. We at Walters Kluwer Health believe in and abide by strict federal and state laws to prohibit the improper use or disclosure of patients' health information. Patient privacy is just not an issue in this debate. We support efforts to protect the privacy of personal health information for patients, and we applaud your efforts to do the same. Our own policies and practices to protect patient privacy include multiple encryption techniques and many overlapping safeguards so that the data we provide to assist healthcare stakeholders in no way allow identification of individual patients. Now, supporters of the legislative efforts to restrict the use of data maintained early on that the use of the data compromised patient and physician privacy interests when no such risk has ever been demonstrated. Two federal judges have said that there's no privacy issue here, and we agree. We also understand your desire to manage health care costs. Minnesota has shown great strides in managing health care costs for its citizens. The measure before you today, however, is not likely to deliver on the promise to cut costs. To date, there is no information or evidence that prescriber data restriction laws will reduce costs, and there's significant information to the contrary that suggests marketplace practices already exist to manage costs without the need for data restrictions that may compromise patient care. For example, the state of New Hampshire, as already mentioned, they've enacted and implemented a law to restrict the use of data. They restricted these data for approximately 9 months between 2006 and 2007. There was no impact on prescription costs, and no savings to the state were realized as a result. Likewise, the dispensing of brand name medications has declined from 5.7% of total prescriptions in 2003 to only 1.3% in 2008. At the same time, generic medications that are generally cheaper than the brand name medications grew to represent 70% of dispensed prescriptions in 2008, up from 40% in 2003. Now, given these trends, it's difficult to make any credible arguments about how the existence of data drives costs in the system. It also dispels any assertion that use of the data influences physicians to prescribe only more expensive drugs, as our proponents claim. Now, it's unlikely that banning the commercial use of prescriber identifiable data will decrease marketing by sales reps. In the absence of this information, pharmaceutical firms will likely have to increase the number of sales reps they use to adequately deliver product messages to a larger number of physicians, or to market to physicians who may not have cause to prescribe particular drugs, or both, resulting in increased costs. Marketing would be less efficient, more scattered, less focused, and thus increasing the cost of these marketing efforts. Now, on the issue of physician choice, the notion that prescriber identifiable information is used to persuade physicians to make inappropriate prescribing decisions is not supported by any research, and in fact defies common sense. Physicians are among the most educated and respected professionals in the country and are more than capable to make informed prescribing decisions. Physicians have access to alternative sources of information that are highly regarded and therefore heavily influence their prescribing practices, such as scientific papers, advice from colleagues, and even their own training and experience. But more than anything, they have the choice. There's a perfectly appropriate private sector solution put forth by the American Medical Association. It's the Physician Data Restriction Program, where doctors can choose whether to share their data or not. To date, almost 22,000 doctors have chosen to use this easy online tool to opt out. 307 doctors in the state of Minnesota have already chosen that option. Now, finally, health information transparency is vital to promoting the quality, safety, and integrity of the nation's healthcare system. In the public and private sectors, demand for an evidence-based medicine, accountability, and transparency has never been greater. Thorough analysis and unrestricted use of public and commercial databases containing transparent prescriber-level data is essential to achieving a better understanding of medical practices, quality variation, and patient outcomes. Our prescriber data is used by a wide spectrum of healthcare industry leaders and the government, including drug safety programs, disease research, clinical trials, reducing geographic variation in quality, and improving healthcare quality and patient outcomes. There's broad consensus in the healthcare community that a robust health information system is a positive and essential step toward improving our healthcare system. We at Walters Kluwer Health are actively engaged in the healthcare reform debate taking place on the state and federal levels of government. We agree with President Obama that healthcare reform cannot wait and must not wait another year. That's why Walters Kluwer Health opposes data restriction laws which impede the free flow of information that does not compromise the privacy of individual patients. These legislative proposals undermine the principle of transparency, which is an underlying tenet of healthcare reform. This assertion is repeatedly expressed by healthcare experts, agencies, thought leaders of both political parties, as well as the AARP, the SEIU, and a host of consumer advocacy groups. Mr. Chairman, in closing, I'd like to say that the responsible use of prescription information data promotes efficiencies in the system and may help lower costs. There are numerous uses for the data that serve the public's interest. At a time when greater transparency and free flow of information is being advanced, any restriction that will impede this initiative is not only misguided, but may have serious constitutional implications. Over the past several years, legislation House Bill 491 has been introduced in more than 24 states, and virtually all states have rejected them. Only New Hampshire, Vermont, and Maine have adopted these types of restrictions, and those laws are all subject to constitutional challenges in federal court. In conclusion, we firmly believe that the public good and that of the state of Minnesota is best served by evidence-based medicine, improved transparency in the healthcare system, and continued responsible use and access to prescriber identifiable information. We appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today. We submitted our comments for your review and consideration and respectfully request that you reject this measure outright. Thank you again for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Betts. Mr. Rowan, keep your comments to new information or comments that have not been made yet. So, Mr. Rowan, state your name for the record and who you work for, and you may begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Vernon Rowan. I'm the Vice President of Government Affairs for Express Scripts. We're a pharmacy benefit manager. My company's headquartered in St. Louis, Missouri, but we have a large office here in Bloomington, Minnesota, with about 1,500 employees. Express Scripts is a pharmacy benefit manager. We are basically hired by employers, health plans, state governments, departments of the federal government to manage the prescription drug program for their beneficiaries. Our primary charge is to help them appropriately control their drug costs while at the same time improving quality and ensuring that people are getting the right drug at the right time at the best price they can possibly get it. I am not here today to defend physician detailing. As I understand it, that's the primary focus of this bill, is to basically cut off the flow of information so the drug manufacturers are not able to detail individual physicians. We don't support that. In fact, many of the efforts that we engage in are trying to counteract those activities by manufacturers. For example, my company heavily promotes generic drugs. It's one of the ways that we make money. We align our interests with our clients. Our clients save money when generic drugs are prescribed appropriately. We make more money. We do everything we can to promote the use of generics. One of my primary concerns with this bill is not its intent, but the approach that it takes. It attempts to basically choke off the flow of prescriber data and then narrowly define exceptions that allow people to do things that are deemed appropriate public policy initiatives. The problem is, while this bill is better than some other bills that I've seen, it still does not carefully craft the exceptions in a way that would allow, for instance, my company to aggressively promote generics with prescribers. As I've read through the exemptions in the hour or so that I've had to look at this bill, I don't think my company can reach out to physicians and encourage them to use generics. We cannot look at specific physicians that are over-prescribing brand name products compared to their peers and say, gee, have you taken a look at the generics that are available in this drug class, and have you thought about using those for your patients? I do not believe my company would be able to do that under this bill, and I would hope that everyone on the table would agree that that's an important activity that we need to be able to engage in to control the cost of drugs in the marketplace. Beyond that, there are several other examples of things going on in the marketplace that are important to go on, necessary to go on, that I'm not sure this bill would allow to happen. My company also runs specialty pharmacies. These are pharmacies that dispense specialty drugs. These are biologic drugs. They are very complex drugs, complex molecules. They're not oral solids. They're often injected or infused. They're very expensive drugs. There's often only one drug in the class to treat a condition, and they're generally treating very small populations of very sick people. And employers have asked us to go in and begin managing the use of those drugs for their patients, because if they're not used appropriately, it's very expensive, it doesn't result in a good outcome for the patient, and it's a lot of money spent by the employer. Often, the manufacturers of these specialty drugs need to work with one distributor for that drug, because there may only be 1,000 people in the country that actually use the drug, and they need a distributor who knows and understands how that product works. And they can only really trust one individual company to do that. It's often the case, because it's a small population, that there have not been widespread clinical trials on the use of this drug. So we don't always know what the effects are going to be on certain individuals. Therefore, my company often has to look at prescriber-specific data to communicate back to the manufacturer, so the manufacturer can reach out to those physicians and monitor the use of those drugs and provide pretty instant feedback back and forth. I'm not just talking about safety recalls. I'm not talking about widespread problems that the FDA points out and says you need to recall this drug. I'm talking about very specialized situations where there does need to be that type of communication. The communication isn't focused on selling that drug. That's the only drug available for that patient. That's the drug they're going to use. The communication is focused on making sure that there's instant feedback to the manufacturer if there are problems that start to come up with that drug. Let me just point out one other problem with this bill in terms of the exceptions, and that is the relationship to the federal privacy law that the previous speaker just spoke about. I am not clear at all in my mind on how this interacts with the federal HIPAA privacy law. HIPAA is the standard that virtually everyone in the healthcare system uses to protect the privacy of patient identifiable information. And in fact, the standards that are included in HIPAA were just strengthened significantly by Congress in the recent stimulus package. This bill appears to put more stringent controls on patient identifiable information than HIPAA does, which now puts Minnesota at variance with the other 49 states in the country in terms of how you protect patient identifiable information. But beyond that, this seems to provide a higher level of privacy protection for prescriber information than exists in the federal law for patients. And I'm not sure there's good public policy to suggest that prescribers deserve a higher level of protection of their privacy than patients do. So, look, I don't disagree with the objectives of the proponents of this legislation. The legislation they're bringing to us this year is more carefully crafted than last year's, but I'll argue it is still not carefully crafted enough, and I'll argue I'm not sure that you can find the right way to craft enough exceptions to protect the legitimate uses of this information. I would argue that a more targeted approach, if you're concerned about detailing, we take a more targeted approach to get at detailing instead of shutting off all the flow of information and then finding the right exceptions to let it flow. Thank you.
Representative Murphy, specific question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a question and follow-up to the testimony. Can you share with me and the committee why you think that the provider information and their privacy around their practice is less important than that of the information around patients?
Because I think there is a strong public policy argument to be made. If we're going to reform healthcare, if we're going to look at quality of care, if we're going to do comparative effectiveness studies between different procedures and between providers, you need to be able to identify who the providers are to do that kind of comparative study.
And Mr. Chair, follow-up? Thanks, Mr. Chair. So the information that you're talking about, would that be available to public policymakers?
Mr. Rowland? The prescriber, potentially to state agencies that might be looking at quality initiatives in this state or measurement initiatives in this state? Absolutely.
Okay.
With respect to individual providers, it's going to depend on the state law.
Thank you. We're going to move to the testimony, and we'll finish, and then we'll entertain all kinds of questions. I understand members have many. Mr. Noy, if you have additional information to add to what's already been said. State your name for the record, who you work for, then you can continue.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Khalil Nuri, and I'm a policy director for the Pharmaceutical Research Manufacturers of America. And most of our arguments and positions have been aptly laid out by the two of them, so I'm not going to take up much of your time. But I do want to emphasize several key points. One, I think we are all patient advocates. We all want what's best for the patient. That's our number one concern. And I think that's why they're talking about generic usage and everything else. And from our perspective, the only person that can is in the best interest of the patient is the prescriber. And so in order for them to do that, they need to have as much information as possible. And that's what the detailers are there to do, is to give them as much information as possible. And I have faith in their judgment that they are able to decipher what information is correct and disseminate that and make the correct course of action for the patient. And secondly, I think what we really need to point out is that patient identifiable information is protected, and as they aptly pointed, under HIPAA, and that's the most important thing. And some of the assertions that were made earlier about, and I don't want to reiterate, but the skyrocketing costs that detailers and this marketing does is completely incorrect. And I have several things here from the CMS that was just released in January
that I'd like to pass out to give to the page in there.
Okay.
One of the assertions from the prescription project is marketing based on prescriber data is a key factor in skyrocketing costs of prescription drugs and the increased usage of expensive brand name medicines. There's no support for this statement. The prescription drug costs are not skyrocketing. In 2007, prescription drug costs increased at the slowest pace since 1963. Moreover, 67% of prescriptions filled in 2007 were generic drugs, an increase of 7% since 2000. I mean, and those are just some of the facts, and many more are in this document that we just passed out, and we'd be happy to take questions. Thank you. We'll encourage all the members to read it. We'll go with the questions. Representative Norton.
I think I'd like to ask a question that related to where Representative Murphy was ending the conversation. I think. Well, let me back up. One of the comments that was made in your testimony, and this is to the gentleman from, is it Express?
Express, correct.
Mr. Rowan.
Thank you. Was that this particular piece of legislation is going to thwart your efforts to reach specific physicians. And I guess, and maybe my question isn't to you, you might know the answer, to Representative Liebling, but as I understand it, this doesn't stop you from contacting physicians, it just stops you from contacting identified physicians. So you still could contact all physicians with the, if I'm understanding the bill correctly, with the information you would want, and you would hit the ones that you want. You just, it would be more costly for you because you wouldn't know exactly which one to target. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Rowan, and then we'll have our Representative Levin also answer that question as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, you're right. That, in fact, that may be what it would force us to do, but we'd have to make a cost-benefit analysis. Right now, we can target someone who's a high prescriber of brand name Lipitor, for example. We'll just use an example. My company saves our clients literally hundreds of millions of dollars when Zocor, a cholesterol medication, went generic. Simvastatin became available. Lipitor, the highest cost product in that category of drugs, was also the most prescribed. But for the first time, there was a generic version of a cholesterol-controlling medication that was available in the marketplace that was comparable to Lipitor for most patients. We were able to reach out to prescribers who were most often prescribing Lipitor and educate them on using generic Simvastatin. And we were literally able to save hundreds of millions of dollars for our clients. Sure, we could send a communication to every doctor in the country about this. But you know what? They're going to get that from everyone. And what they're going to get is barraged with communication from every drug company, from every PBM, and from every health plan, as opposed to getting targeted communications, which are a better use of our resources, which, by extension, are the resources of my clients. Because if it costs me money to do it, it's going to cost my clients more money for their benefit. So we would argue it's more effective to be able to target these communications.
And then if I could follow up to this question, and this is, I think, more the spinoff where Representative Murphy was coming from at the end of her conversation. If physicians can opt out anyway, and I guess I'm frankly wondering why we need this law if physicians can opt out anyway, so I'm still kind of wrestling with that, just that whole concept. But if physicians can opt out anyway, it's not going to help your situation, because if physicians maybe aren't opting out because they're not aware of this, and we make them aware of it and they all opt out, you're back to square one anyway.
Well, we're not in, Mr. Chair, Representative Norton. This program's been available for some time, and we haven't seen widespread opting out of it. Yeah, you're right. In a theoretical world, if everyone opted out, then we're in trouble. We're not going to stand in the way of an individual prescriber that says, I don't want you to use my information that way. But as a company, I am going to object to basically shutting off the flow of that information except for very limited circumstances, because it really does interfere with my ability to do what my clients hired me to do.
Mr. Rowan,
Chairman, if I may, to address part of her question?
Go ahead, Chris.
Real quickly, what you said was absolutely correct, and what the opt-out program does, it allows the doctor to have the choice as opposed to it being blanketed. It gives them the choice to opt out if they want to. And in the information I passed out to you, 84% of the doctors said that they liked the information.
Mr. Rowan, I just want to do a follow-up. You're saying a company
when you find out about a generic brand, you encourage them, the doctors, to go. Do you do the reverse? When if doctors are using generic, and you would encourage them to go and use a more brand name, do you also do the reverse of that as well in your company?
The only way that would happen is if in a category of drugs, so let's say there's five drugs in the category and there are generics available in that category.
Oh, I said, do you guys do it?
Well, I'm trying to explain a circumstance where we might. We haven't done that.
Okay.
However, let me just say, I think theoretically we would. If a new drug came to the market in that category that was clinically superior to every other drug in that category to treat that condition, we would promote the brand name drug because it's clinically better.
So you never done it for price-wise?
We wouldn't do it for price.
Okay.
The only way because you raised that issue, let me say the only time price becomes a consideration is after we've evaluated the clinical effectiveness of all the drugs in a category. If one drug is clearly superior to all the drugs in the category, or even marginally superior, that's the drug that is promoted. If there are three drugs that are roughly the same in terms of effectiveness, then we look at price, because that's what it makes sense to do. That's what a prudent consumer would do. If you have three cars that are virtually the same quality, you're going to buy the one that's least expensive, and that's what we do.
Representative Levin, do you have something to add to that question?
Okay. Well, you know, some very good questions here, members, and maybe we could let Mr. Wyckoff have a seat here, too, as well. Okay. Help me. Members, a lot of this conversation is about stuff that's not in this bill. If you read the bill, it's very closely, carefully tailored. It does not cut off the flow of information, which these testifiers have been worried about at all. All it does is restrict a particular use of this information, which is for this kind of marketing. So a lot of the wringing of hands here is just about something that we're not even raising. If you look at the bill, for example, on 2.19, 2.20, etc., you know, non-marketing purposes, which this allows, include...
Representative Levin, can we get the page to get seats to the other testifier next to you? And so, go ahead, Representative Levin.
What did you want to do?
Oh, we're just getting the page. Give them chairs.
Oh, okay.
You want to be best.
All right. So, if you look at 2.20, you know, non-marketing purposes include but are not limited to educational or quality assurance programs conducted by a health plan company or a benefits management program. This last testifier, that's who he is. To ensure compliance with an independently established formulary based on evidence-based prescribing guidelines and cost containment goals. So if you read through this, we are not cutting off information. We're just saying you can't use it for this particular purpose. So in terms of research, in terms of policy setting, there is nothing to stop this information from being collected and used for other permissible purposes, just not for marketing to physicians. So... And if it isn't clear enough, we can make it clearer, because that is not our intent. It's a very narrowly tailored bill, and I don't know...
Representative Huntley?
Well, I had a question for Mr. Owen. The way I understand it, you would be hired by an insurance company to do the pharmacy benefit part of their company, and you are actually not part of a pharmaceutical company.
Mr. Rowan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, that's correct. We're an independent organization that is hired by employers and insurers, anyone who purchases health care coverage.
And Mr. Rowan, when a physician that writes whatever insurance company or self-insured, does the prescription go directly to you to pay it, or does it go to the insurance company?
Mr. Rowan.
It depends on the arrangement that we have with them, but generally it comes to us. We're their agent for paying their claims, and we also do a number of other things to help them manage the benefit.
And then, Mr. Owen, so you're not involved with the detailing, which is fine, I guess, why is it that you feel you couldn't get that information and contact the physician on his prescribing habits?
Mr. Rowan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, I know the intent is to try to carefully craft these. They're not carefully crafted enough to allow us to do what we do to promote generic drugs. There's at best a conflict between the definition, what's included in the definition of marketing, and what's included in the definition of non-marketing. You point to the definition of non-marketing activities in terms of formulary compliance, but formulary compliance is limited to educational or quality assurance programs, not cost containment programs or compliance with the benefit structure of the plan.
That one here is line 220-222, Mr. Chairman, that clearly is allowed for that.
I respectfully disagree, Mr. Wyckoff, and I actually work for the company that does this.
Go through the chair, please.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I apologize.
Okay. Representative Huntley, are you finished, or?
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Owen, I certainly agree that if somebody in the insurance company or in the pharmacy benefit management ought to be able to look at what an individual physician is prescribing and notify that person of the results and what they think about it. What I'm not sure of is whether this bill prevents you from doing that.
Okay. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not exactly sure where to start because I've got a whole host of questions, but why don't I start in the beginning?
Do your best.
Generally speaking, on a bipartisan basis, there's been significant opposition to legislation that has an intent or a purpose statement associated with it. When I look at the Subdivision 1 in this bill, my concern is that it's putting into statute the implication that doctors aren't doing the right thing. And by using the language of maintaining the integrity and public trust in the medical profession and combating vexatious, I had actually asked the lawyer sitting to my left what that meant. I think some of the language that's put forward in this intent is of concern. Representative Liebling, I would wonder if you would be willing to strike that subdivision. Mr. Chairman, I have a number of follow-up questions.
Representative Liebling.
Right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Broad, actually, when this was brought to me, I actually raised that question myself because I know you're right. We generally don't have an intent statement. And what I was told is that the proponents wanted to just have this in initially so that it would be, you know, clear to everyone and it would be part of the record what our intent is. And certainly it would be my intent to take that out before we would have a final bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move to strike Subdivision 1.
Representative Broad moves to strike Subdivision 1.
And
what's that?
Excuse me, Section 2, Subdivision 1. Thank you.
Section 2, 1.11 through 1.21, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Lieber.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Broad. I appreciate that. And as I said, it is my intent to do that, but I would rather not do it at this stage. I think that it's helpful to have it there. This is going to go to another committee, and but you do have my commitment that I will before we would get this bill to the floor. I think we would take that out.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Liebling. I think this section is specific to our committee. When we're talking about what's going on within the healthcare realm, this section should be dealt with in this committee. It's not a commerce issue. It's not a civil law issue, which I believe this should also go to civil law. It's not a government operations issue, because now I believe with your amendment, this bill is going to have to go to government operations as well due to the reporting requirement. And so I think it's appropriate for this committee to make the decision to pull this section out. I understand you wanting to move it in. I appreciate your commitment, but we've always tried to remove these purpose statements out. I've had one myself that I pulled out after realizing that early on. So I would appreciate us trying to get this out right now.
Okay, Representative Broad moves to strike Section 2 from 1.11 through 1.21. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. The noes have it. Amendment not adopted. Representative Broad, you got an additional question?
I do, Mr. Chairman. Page 2. I'm trying to understand the definition of marketing, and the way I read it, Representative Liebling, it says marketing means any activity by an entity
So if I was a creative soul, I might hire a consultant to do my marketing for me, and this bill would not cover that. Is that your understanding?
Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, I think the intent here is to cover such an entity that I think that is exactly the intent here, to make sure that anybody that you would be, to whom you would be contracting the making or selling of prescribed products would be covered by this.
And then, Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, I'm concerned about, I think Mr. Rowan actually hit it on the nail on the head on this one, related to the sharing of information about a product. So if I go in and educate a doctor about something that inadvertently leads to a prescription or a sale, how does that fit? I'm not trying to sell it. It just, he likes the product. I educated him well or her well, and they understand it and want to use it.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, I don't think there's anything in this bill that prevents you from doing that, as long as you're not, the point of the bill is to prevent the use of prescriber information to do that. This doesn't stop any detail person from walking in, or unless maybe I misunderstood your question, but are you talking about using prescriber information and then inadvertently using it to sell something?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, what I'm trying to understand is your definition of marketing and how it relates to somebody providing information, using that information, and then what happens if there was a sale down the road. I guess I'm trying to understand how that actually works. I don't think it's clear, and maybe I'm just misunderstanding it.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, you know, there's nothing in here that's preventing marketing of drugs. What's being prevented by this bill is the use of this kind of data to market to physicians. So maybe I'm missing your point here, but it just seems to me that there's, and you have to be, for selling the data with an intent that it be used in such a way.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what I'm trying to get at is that I don't think it's written that clearly, and if I use the data for the purposes of educating somebody, but then it inadvertently ends up in a sale, have I violated the section?
Definitely.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Broad, I mean, I think this is one of those kinds of issues that is pretty fact-based. I mean, if it's genuinely not intended to be used for marketing and ends up in a sale, then I don't think that's really a problem. I don't think it would be a violation.
I guess I'd say it's important to distinguish the definitions of education.
Mr. Wyckoff.
Mr. Beaumont,
actually. Mr. Beaumont. Sorry.
I think it's important to distinguish the definitions of education and marketing. If I were to ask most people here what's the best search engine on the Internet, most people would probably say Google. Why? Is it actually the best? Or have you just heard Google, 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 seen it all over the place, it's on your browser? It's an issue of when does education become marketing, because repetition does affect engagement.
Chairman, just to clarify, I'm Peter Wyckoff in the area. Under this law, the person would not have the prescriber data information. They are free to market the heck out of their product, and they do. So it's not an issue. Unless they've broken the law and have that data.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're walking around in circles, and I think that's part of the point I'm trying to make, is that I think that there aren't those clear lines between marketing and education. I've always been told that some of the best marketing is good information, and some of the best ways to sell a product is giving people quality, solid educational facts. And so my concern is that fine line. You're absolutely right. Is when does one become the other and inadvertently create violations within the system? But having put that on the table for discussion, I just wanted to run to a couple other sections in the bill.
Just real quick, I think I could answer that by saying a non-biased source is how you distinguish education from.
Thank you, Mr. Bowman. Representative Robbie, I intend to take a vote on this bill, and we have many people on the list. We'll give you one more shot.
I'm just trying to get through the actual details of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
And we're going to go to Representative Gatwa.
Mr. Chairman, I just had one more question related to the enforcement section of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Liebling, is this now going to go to civil law? Is that the plan?
Representative Broad, this bill will it's going to go to Commerce next?
Yeah, no, I understand the motion, Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. but I'm trying to understand is the path of the bill going forward.
Representative Liebling, do you know the path after that?
I
or?
Don't, Mr. Chairman.
If it needs to, I think the chair that will request it. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am wondering, we've heard references to the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, and I'm wondering if anybody is here who can comment. Have they taken a formal position, Representative Liebling? Have we heard? I haven't heard any testimony to it, but.
Representative Liebling, do you know?
I don't know, Mr. Chair. I'm going to let Mr. Wyckoff.
Cody Weiberg, Chair of the Board of Pharmacy, is actively engaged in all these issues and has testified personally in this. Whether the board has a position, I can't tell you.
Okay. Good. Representative Emmer. Oh, anyone from the board? It doesn't look like it. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Beaumont, something I was listening and interested. You said there's got to be a distinction between education and marketing. Seems to me that they're one and the same. And just to take Representative Broad's questions one step farther, because you said it has to be from some unbiased source. And forgive me for being a little suspicious, but who's the unbiased source that's going to be able to take the data, the information that you're going to use to educate somebody that hopefully, if they learn enough about the drug that you're educating them about, they decide that it makes sense to use it, prescribe it. Who is that unbiased source?
Mr. Bowman.
My view would be a physician who is not on the payroll of any of the involved products.
But that's the problem, Mr. Chair and Mr. Beaumont. The same physician that you're going to have to educate with the same information you're saying now is going to be the unbiased source. This makes no sense to me whatsoever. Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, why are we doing this? What's the outcry? Why is this so necessary?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, I mean, first of all, let me just, you know, remind you that there's lots of in-service education for physicians that comes from unbiased sources. They have to get continuing medical education credits. A lot of times their employers do grand rounds where they're learning about different topics. There are lots of ways physicians get educated about the use of drugs other than from the companies themselves. And the purpose of this is very narrowly tailored at the use of this prescriber information being used for marketing purposes. That is the intent of the bill. It doesn't stop the drug companies from marketing otherwise at all. It only aims at the use of that information for detailing purposes, for marketing purposes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, you didn't answer my question, which is why is this, what is the outcry for this legislation? And then I will disagree with it. Granted, you've done a lot of work on this, and I haven't. I just had a chance to read your bill. When you write the term entity, all of the entities that you've just described that deliver these unbiased presentations, one, I don't know that they all deal with specialty drugs, by the way. There's been some testimony that's going to be impacted here, but they're potentially entities as well if they're using this information. Granted, under one part of your bill, it can fit as an educational purpose, but if it does lead to a sale of the drug, it's also a potential violation. So, I don't know that it is drafted narrowly. I have more questions as to why it's necessary than just questions about the language of the bill. And again, if you could tell me why we need to pass this, what is the purpose?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, I don't know if you were here in the beginning of the presentation, Representative Emmer, but I think we did present some information, and I think you have some in your packet about the financial consequences of this. And it basically drives up costs for consumers. That's the ultimate problem.
If that's it, then I don't buy it. Thanks.
We're going to go to Representative Abler, and then I intend to vote on it. We have spent over an hour on this, so Representative Abler.
Thanks, and I what a well spent hour it's been too, and I've sat here for the whole thing. Mr. Liebling, you've tackled a hard project here. In the first bill of the day, we heard a bill about trying to help people that are on unemployment get some relief in the short term, and that bill changed quite a bit as it between one hearing and the next. And I actually added on as a co-author to your original bill, and then I'm going to figure out what I've gotten myself into in the second version here. We piled on the detailing people. I bet Mr. Nuri actually probably from pharma side is more favorable to those, because that's his entity. And you all have different interests. Every witness there has a different interest about what they want. And I'm trying to figure out the truth here. And I hate to see us pass a bill out that has such a divergence of honest opinion from good people. And it's going to work in this in the meantime. Maybe hold it over and we can find some way to get the good out of it here and get some more consensus. I think I don't know how the votes are lined up here, but I don't see it's going to be a consent calendar bill. And I'll leave it at that. The chair is interested in time, but I just wanted to, I'm not sure how I'm going to vote. but maybe we should work on it.
Representative Liebling, closing remarks.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, concerns expressed here about the pharmacy benefit managers, we can certainly, we can put in the bill that is excluded. I mean, I don't have a problem with that, and it will make it clear. I don't see the argument that it can never be clear enough. I mean, I just can't buy that. We can find language that excludes them and takes care of that problem. Representative Abler, this is about big money. A lot of people have big stake in this. It is billions of dollars, and you are not going to get consensus because you are telling people that they cannot do something which is very lucrative to do. That's what this bill is doing, and that's why you're going to have lots of opposition to it. So you're going to have to take a side here. I'm willing to work with legitimate interests. I think this is pretty narrowly tailored already, and if there are legitimate concerns, I'm certainly willing to work on them. But to say that we're going to have to get consensus with the pharmaceutical companies on this before we can pass it out, I don't think so, Representative Aitman.
Representative Broad has a motion, and we're going to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Liebling, I don't agree with your characterization that this is about what the bill is about. But, Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Abler has it right. I think the bill needs some work, and I think if the other committees want to see it, they certainly can do what many other committees are doing, which is hearing the bill without it in their possession. I think this is one that we should keep, because I think the concerns on this bill are related to health care, not commerce or civil law or government operations. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move to table the bill.
Representative Broad moves to table the bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The no. Division is called. Raise your hand. All those in favor of tabling the bill, raise your hand. All those opposed, raise your hand. Nine ayes and 11 opposed. The noes have it. We'll move on to vote on the Representative Gottwall, last one.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just need to clarify that point earlier, Representative Liebling, Mr. Chair, and members. If this bill were about not the billions of dollars and preventing advertising of drugs, we could have a different discussion. But as you testified yourself, this is about accessing data to do certain informational processes. And that's where I get a little more bogged down. And so I just want to be clear about what we're voting on here. This is a different thing than just combating what some might consider exorbitant spending by pharmaceutical companies on advertising.
Mr. Chairman, roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Liebling renews the motion that House File 491, as amended, be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce. Clerk, take the roll.
Tao.
Aye.
Abler.
No for today.
Broad.
No.
Bunn.
Aye.
Emmer.
No.
Fritz.
Aye.
Gardner.
Aye.
Scott Waltz.
No.
Hayden.
Aye.
Huntley.
Aye for today.
Kelly.
No.
Lane.
Aye.
Liebling.
Aye.
Loeffler.
Aye.
Mack.
No.
Murphy.
Aye.
Norton.
Pass.
Rood.
Aye.
Torkelson.
No.
Eleven ayes and seven nays. A bill has been adopted and move on to commerce.
Thank you.
Meeting adjourned.